Trump's historic visit is viewed as an icebreaker to forge stronger ties between Seoul and Tehran after years of strained relations. Now to start with, Tehran says Seoul should unlock billions of dollars of Iranian assets frozen in its banks.
The figure is roughly $8.5 billion of Iranian revenues made from oil sales to Seoul. The funds are now blocked in two South Korean banks for fears of running afoul of U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Tehran says South Korea's inaction toward the issue has been the main barrier in the way of further development of bilateral relations.
Unfortunately, relations between Tehran and Seoul have not seen any development in the past 3 years due to South Korea's adherence to U.S. anti-Iran sanctions that lack any international legitimacy.
The South Korean premier said his country is determined to solve the issue and will make its utmost efforts to prepare the ground for Iran's access to its assets.
South Korea will increase its cooperation with the related countries to unfreeze the Iranian financial resources. This is to get both sides out of the current deadlock in bilateral relations.
Before the U.S. intensified its sanctions on Iran, South Korea was one of the country's largest trade partners outside West Asia and its fourth largest oil customer. Following the 2015 nuclear deal, bilateral trade reached $12 billion in 2017. Yet these exports tumbled down after the U.S. reinstated anti-Iran sanctions in 2018, dropping to minus $90 million in the first half of 2020.
South Korea used to be one of the major clients of Iran oil, and Iran was also a permanent market for South Korea technology from car to home appliances, but this active partnership was abruptly halted by United States sanctions, and I think the two sides have made up their mind to resume their friendly ties despite the United States will.
Trump's visit follows the Islamic Republic's release of a South Korean oil tanker about 3 months after its seizure over alleged oil pollution. The move is interpreted by observers as an act of rapprochement that, if Seoul compensates by releasing the Iranian assets, can open a new chapter in the two countries' political and trade ties. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which led to the ouster of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Israel, which is also a fierce opponent of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, has been behind the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the past years. On Sunday, Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in the central province of Isfahan was hit by a power outage. Israeli media confirmed that the Mossad spy agency carried out a cyber attack on the site. Iran also blamed the Israeli regime for the incident.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. It can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident will not slow down the country's nuclear program, rather it will speed up its advancement. He said the IR-1 centrifuges damaged in the blackout will be replaced with more advanced ones. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also accused Israel of sabotaging the Natanz facility and pledged revenge against Tel Aviv for the attack. Zarif suggested that the attack was an attempt to derail the talks held in the Austrian capital with the aim of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The European Union also said the incident in Natanz could have been an act of sabotage and warned against any attempts to derail the JCPOA talks, which will resume on Wednesday in Vienna between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal.
And the bottom line for us is that we are saying that we are rejecting any attempts to undermine or to derail the ongoing diplomatic activities to try to resolve all the open questions regarding Iranian nuclear deal. We try to resolve them through diplomatic means currently in Vienna in the ongoing process of talks and negotiations of the parties of the JCPOA and through our contacts with the United States.
Russia also expressed hope that the attack on the Iranian nuclear facility will not undermine the Vienna negotiations. The Sunday attack came as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Israel for talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. U.S. media say Washington, which is Israel's closest ally, was not involved in the attack on the Natanz facility. But the timing of Austin's trip has raised doubts about the claim. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stressed that Tehran cannot trust promises made by the new U.S. administration regarding the revival of the JCPOA. Now the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility can deepen the distrust as the incident further questions the sincerity of such promises.
The Islamic Jihad movement and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine held a sit-in in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The event took place near the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing in northern Gaza. The move comes as thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to suffer from inhumane treatment and are being denied their basic rights. The Israeli regime has imprisoned nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Many Palestinian prisoners suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment by Israel's prison service, who runs Israeli prisons.
The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine came together today to express solidarity with the prisoners who are languishing in Israeli jails. The conditions of prisoners are only getting worse as days go by under the watchful eye of the international community.
Palestinian prisoners are subjected to degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits. Palestinians say that Arab countries normalizing relations with the Israeli regime are encouraging Tel Aviv to violate the rights of Palestinians.
The normalization by Arab regimes has badly affected the conditions of Palestinian prisoners. Normalization of ties with the Zionists is a betrayal of Palestine and the Palestinian prisoners. All Arabs must understand that the United States and Israel are the enemies of the Arab and Muslim nations.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against Israeli occupation. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, vowed to use all forms of resistance to free Palestinian prisoners.
The so-called peace deals will not free Palestinian prisoners. Only resistance can free Palestinian prisoners from Zionist jails. Capturing more Israeli soldiers to exchange them with Palestinian prisoners must be a top priority for all Palestinian resistance groups.
Statistics show that over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967 due to medical negligence.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Israel is currently holding some 5,000 Palestinians behind bars, including women and children. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The Yemeni army says two of its drones hit Jizan Airport and King Khalid Air Base, both in southwestern Saudi Arabia. The army says this is part of intensified attacks to retaliate Riyadh's ongoing war on Yemen.
We are entitled to carry out the attacks as part of our normal and legitimate right to respond to the escalation of Saudi Arabia and its comprehensive blockade on our country. And we promise the Saudi regime more painful operations as long as the aggression and siege continues.
His comments come as over the past months, Saudi Arabia has either roundly denied any Yemeni attacks inside the country or claimed Yemeni missiles and drones were intercepted before making impact.
The Saudi regime realizes that it may lose face if people of the country come to know about the Yemeni attacks. The Saudi regime is controlling its people by force and it is afraid of an internal revolution against the ruling regime. So, this is why Riyadh continues to avoid talking about the Yemeni attacks.
Military experts say the Yemeni army is well capable of expanding its attacks to a wider range of targets to make them more painful for Riyadh. They say this could inflict greater damage to Saudi Arabia economically and militarily.
Saudi Arabia must realize that the painful phase is yet to come. Saudi Arabia will lose its economic power and military capabilities in this phase. Saudi Arabia says its army is the sixth most powerful army in the world, but 6 years of war on Yemen have proven that the Saudi army is extremely weak and has achieved nothing, while the Yemeni military capabilities have increased. And I believe that the continuation of this war is further damaging to the kingdom.
The Yemeni army's escalation of retaliatory attacks is a response to the deadly Saudi-led aggression and siege that caused the deaths of tens of thousands of people, many of them women and the children.
Saudi Arabia has been calling for peace talks with Yemeni forces to stop their attacks while refusing to grant the demand to end its years-long war and siege on Yemen. This leaves the Yemeni army no option but to step up its retaliatory attacks against the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Istanbul. The visit comes amid tensions between Kiev and Moscow over Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. Meanwhile, Russia bulked up its military presence on Ukraine's eastern border, threatening military action. During the meeting, the two presidents spoke about ways of cooperation in different sectors and strengthening ties between the two countries, including free trade, tourism, and sports. Following the meeting, which was also attended by ministers from both sides, a number of agreements were signed.
Turkey strongly defends the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. We hope that the escalation in eastern Ukraine will come to an end and the conflict will be resolved through dialogue based on the Minsk agreement.
The United States, after informing Turkey as per the Montreux Convention, sent two warships through Turkish straits towards the Black Sea. Turkish Foreign Ministry said the warships will stay in the Black Sea until May 4.
The tension between Russia and Ukraine is increasing every minute. Ukraine is waiting for support from the EU and the US. But Russia has clearly expressed that Crimea is its red line and will not give it to Ukraine. I think this visit is aimed at sorting things out. Ukraine wants to make sure that Turkey is on its side, especially after the phone call between Turkish and Russian presidents.
Late on Friday, Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed with his Turkish counterpart over the phone the Ukraine crisis and the presence of U.S. warships in the Black Sea. Turkish president assured that Ankara's cooperation with Ukraine does not mean it is against Russia. Analysts believe Turkey is trying to play the role of peacemaker in the region without taking sides. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was an utter shock for the destitute Rohingya community in India after the country's Supreme Court rejected the petition seeking halt on the deportation process. The court in its ruling said the deportation process could go ahead as long as the government follows due process. Now more panic has gripped the community as their last hope seems lost. Experts say the Supreme Court ruling will give a sense of relief to the community for a while from being deported instantly. They, however, believe the ruling doesn't stop the detention process. Rather, it gives government more freedom to act swiftly. Legal experts are shocked about the judgment, saying the country has welcomed refugees from several countries since decades, but adopted a hostile approach towards Rohingya in particular. India has no legislation on the refugees, and it considers Rohingya as illegal immigrants and a threat to national security.
They can be deported in accordance with the law. Now, which law? Law, according to the government, means the Foreigners Act. Now, Foreigners Act doesn't deal with refugees. Refugees are a different category of people. We had argued that even non-citizens, even refugees, have Article 21 rights, the right to life.
In recent weeks, dozens or more refugees were detained from New Delhi. The police maintains they have orders from higher authorities to carry detention process. Now grief has befallen the destitute community. Rights activists say treating these refugees differently is a blow on India's ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family.
Why why is it not our concern if there are refugees coming from there? It's not just the refugee law. There are so many laws dealing with the rights of children, the Human Rights Convention, the Civil and Political Rights Convention. They all talk about the principle of non-refoulement, which means that you cannot send somebody to a country or outside your territory where there will be danger to his life or limb.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
راه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon thee. By Muhammad, the chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Just 2 days after the Israeli regime's sabotage at the Natanz nuclear facility, Iran announces the terrorist act has not been able to achieve its goal of hampering the country's internationally verified peaceful nuclear program. Iran will not only replace the damaged centrifuges with more advanced ones, it'll also put to operation 1,000 more advanced centrifuges soon. On top of that, Iran will raise uranium enrichment level from 20% to 60% as of tomorrow. And all this while, Tehran is engaged in talks with the P4 plus one in Vienna regarding the lifting of U.S. imposed sanctions aimed at reviving the nuclear deal. Stay with us for a debate on different aspects of this issue.
Iran has officially informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of its plan to start enriching uranium to a 60% purity level as of Wednesday, following Sunday's act of sabotage against the country's Natanz nuclear facility that Tehran blamed on Israel.
Yesterday, we send a letter to the agency that we are going to add 1,000 more centrifuges to Natanz facility. That is in addition to the current number of machines. Also today, we just send a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%.
Araghchi said the terror act against the Natanz site will help boost Iran's enrichment capacities. He also touched upon Iran's demands that it would put forward during the upcoming talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA in Vienna.
We insist on what we have asked, that all sanctions should be lifted, we verify, and then we go back to full compliance if we are satisfied with the verification process.
President Hassan Rouhani also said all parties to the 2015 pact must honor the commitments they made while inking the accord. The Vienna talks that will be held this week have been eclipsed by the sabotage incident at Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment facility. In a letter to the UN chief, Iran's foreign minister blamed Israel for the incident, saying the move amounts to a war crime and nuclear terrorism. Mohammad Javad Zarif also denounced what he called Israel's terrorist idiocy, saying the regime has made a very bad gamble by sabotaging the Natanz facility that would strengthen Iran's hand in talks to salvage the JCPOA. He also warned the U.S. that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage can serve as leverage in JCPOA talks.
Americans should know that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage will give them leverage in the negotiations, and that such measures will only make things harder for them.
Israeli media have acknowledged that Israel was behind the incident at the Iranian nuclear facility, but the U.S., Israel's closest ally, has denied any involvement. Nonetheless, on the same day that the Natanz site was targeted, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was meeting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed again to do everything in his power to stop a verse for salvaging the JCPOA. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it wants to revive the Iran nuclear deal, but for now, the sabotage act at the Natanz facility has further deepened Tehran's distrust towards Washington.
Okay, now let's start the debate here. Joining me tonight here will be security analyst Mohan Abed in our Tehran studios. We'll also have journalist and commentator Julia Qasem joining us out of Beirut. Good to have you, both of you in the show. Now let's go to Mohan first. Mohan, this is not the first time that the Tel Aviv regime is trying to throw a wrench into Iran's peaceful nuclear program. But the irony is that the hostile action prompted Iran to further its nuclear activity. As of tomorrow, as you know, Iran will start uranium enrichment at 60%. The country will also put to operation 1,000 advanced centrifuges. It looks like that the Israeli scheme has failed again, don't you agree?
Well, you know, Israel and other hostile states have been trying to sabotage Iran's civilian nuclear program and other critical national infrastructure for more than 15 years now. And these sabotage operations have taken different forms, cyber attacks, terrorism, bomb attacks, the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. And with all these attacks, undoubtedly, they gained some operational or technical advantage. But these attacks have never, ever, up to now, managed to change the big strategic picture. They do not change Iran's calculus and Iran's determination to go ahead with its development plans. Now, today's announcement was a very good example. These hostile states, we assume it's Israel, it hasn't been confirmed yet, took action against a critical national infrastructure, and Iran's response is to speed it up nuclear enrichment from 20% to 60%, bring into line new state-of-the-art centrifuges, a new generation of centrifuges. And bear in mind, much of the centrifuges that have been damaged in previous attacks, they belong to a previous generation of centrifuges. So they were, by today's standards, pretty useless anyway. So in direct answer to your question, a hostile state will undertake these actions with a view to gaining some kind of a tactical advantage. But the bottom line is they do not shift the strategic picture. They do not have the desired outcome for the perpetrators. And that's the important point.
Okay. Now let me turn to Beirut. Julia, U.S. Defense Secretary was meeting with Israeli officials at the time of the Natanz sabotage. He spoke of everything except this country's opposition, to Tel Aviv's sabotage of the Iranian Natanz facility. Why should Washington engage in talks to revive the nuclear deal, as it is claiming, at the same time allow Tel Aviv to target Iran's nuclear facility?
Yeah, as was just said, that the cyber attacks against the centrifuges, it has been a tactic in the works for over 15 years now. The first time that it was implemented was through actually a Dutch mole, in collusion with both the CIA and Mossad. So time and time again, these cyber attacks have been an act of collusion between the United States and Israel, which kind of do not act independent of each other remotely, I believe. So it's pretty understandable that there is a collusion going on in their aims of sabotaging Iran's nuclear program. Right now, the Biden administration is kind of operating under the facade of wanting to do negotiations, but on the U.S.'s terms, which is why essentially the talks failed, as the deal failed as well. And with Israel, it's just more of a rogue strategy of kind of achieving the same objectives of sabotaging Iran's nuclear enrichment development. But of course, as we know, Israel is very short-sighted in that regard. Those centrifuges, as was mentioned, were old anyway. They were due to be replaced. So Iran's response in resistance to Israel's attack, but also in full assumption of its own right to develop energy, sovereign energy, has chosen to increase the enrichment to 60% as of tomorrow. So I believe that based off the historical precedent of the cyber attacks, as well as the coinciding goals that both the U.S. and Israel have against Iran, ultimately, that they couldn't have been acting in the course.
Okay, now, Mohan, in the same lines, I want to put this question. Could Tel Aviv have taken this hostile action it took against Iran without informing Washington and getting its green light?
Well, the short answer is no, and I tend to concur to some extent with your guest in Beirut. These actions, these sabotage actions or cyber attacks or other forms of hostile activity, they tend to be collaborative. So it's a case of collusion between several hostile states. Very rarely do they happen independently. Now, we know with the biggest attack to date, there's the so-called Stuxnet attack back in 2010. This was a collaborative effort between the Americans and the Israelis. Now, we don't have sufficient information to determine the extent of collusion in the latest attacks. But the bottom line is that the Israeli entity, you know, it doesn't have the strategic capacity or even wherewithal to act independently. This is this is an established fact, I think, and most experts would concur with that. So, and of course, this creates all sorts of questions because some of these hostile states, whilst they're trying to actively sabotage Iran's nuclear program, they're also at the same time pretending to be engaged in dialogue and diplomacy. So that really calls into question their motivation and their sincerity. And I think this is something which the Iranian diplomatic establishment has to contend with. Just how serious are their diplomatic interlocutors sitting at the other side of the table? Yes.
And of course, Iran has not waited for that, Mohan. Iran is doing its job no matter what comes out of those negotiations.
Well,
now,
just to finish my point, absolutely.
Sure.
So, you know, there's several dimensions here. There's the security dimension, the strategic dimension, and the diplomatic track.
Mm-hmm.
As I explained with the actual nature of these attacks, the damage that they inflict on Iranian infrastructure is at best tactical. They don't change the big strategic picture. And most important of all, they do not alter Iran's strategic calculus. And today's announcement is a testament to that.
Mm-hmm.
Iran has announced that it's going to actually intensify its activities in the nuclear sphere in response to this particular sabotage operation.
Right. Julia, Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif has asserted that neither sanctions nor sabotage can serve as a lever for Washington in the nuclear-related negotiations going on, as you know, if that's what they are pursuing. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, actually both of those things have been factors to actually motivate Iran to pursue its more sovereign strategies of nuclear enrichment, economic development, nuclear development. But it kind of goes to show it's a miscalculation on the U.S. end. And it's why it almost seems like the strategy of, you know, getting Iran to negotiate on the West terms seems like a little bit more of kind of like a diplomatic way of actually sabotaging it and slowing down its nuclear development. As we can remember, a couple days ago, it officially looked like the talks were failing, even though the premise of them, where Washington didn't want to remove the sanctions, poised it to fail from the get-go. But as we kind of saw the confirmation of Washington, you know, not wanting to remove the sanctions, not wanting to live up to its commitments, really. I believe that Israel kind of like launched this last-ditch effort to try to sabotage the centrifuges. But of course, just like the sanctions, that only encourages Iran to further move on its plans to develop its enrichment, you know, enrich its uranium and kind of produce a more sovereign strategy of economic development, given that, you know, the parties on the other side of the table directly or in collusion with these sabotagers to begin with.
Let me ask Mahan this question, that Tehran has strongly criticized, Mahan, what it calls Tel Aviv's nuclear terrorism, because it wouldn't only impact Iran, it could have led to a large-scale environmental issue endangering other parts of the world, too. So the end justifies the means. That's the Israeli approach, right?
Well, this is a really good question, and it speaks to the recklessness of these attacks. The attacks we've seen over the past 15 years have been really dangerous because they are targeted at critical infrastructure. In this instance, a nuclear facility. We know that nuclear facilities the world over are vulnerable assets. We saw the Fukushima thing back in Japan in 2011, other instances when nuclear infrastructure, civilian ones for that matter, somehow become vulnerable, and that this poses huge environmental challenges and huge pressures. Now, in this instance, thankfully, there hasn't been an environmental impact, but the fact remains that attacks of this kind, with callous disregard for the immediate environment, indeed the broader environment, and as you just stated, potentially the global environment, it speaks to the recklessness of these actors. So if the question is, does the end justify the means? Certainly from their point of view, it does. And this just goes to show how important it is for them to halt Iran's progress in the scientific sphere. You know, they are absolutely obsessed by this because they've been taken aback by Iran's strategic momentum in other areas, in the regional domain, but Iran and its allies are victorious. They have the strategic advantage. They have seen how the Trump administration's maximum pressure policy, which amounted to the of an attempt to economically paralyze Iran, they saw that has not worked. The Iranian economy has proven to be much more resilient than they ever anticipated. So they have seen these gains on Iran's part. They have seen that they cannot get the strategic advantage in a conventional sense. So they resort to these attacks with a view to arresting Iran's strategic momentum, with callous disregard for anything else, be it civilians, you know, civilian casualties and damage to the environment.
Julia, Iran has stated clearly that it does reserve the right to revenge in due time, and some analysts criticize it for not giving a strong response to the Israeli move, and there are some others who are praising this as self-restraint that's being practiced by Iran, which they argue that nullifies Tel Aviv's intention to instigate Tehran to kind of rush to take some hasty and harsh action in response. In what context do you assess Iran's stance?
Yeah, so I would say that it's not, you know, restraint in the sense that it just kind of wants to be the peace broker just for the kind of, for a pacifist sense. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that there's really anything to criticize because, I mean, one, what do most of us know about the strategic analysis that Iran is really taking with regards to its response? But also, Iran's not going to respond on Israel's timetable because Israel's going to want to take harsh action based on what it believes is going to be advantageous to it and enable it to kind of wage further strikes against Iran in just a very restless way, of course. Of course, Netanyahu wants war. Of course, the Zionist entity wants war. And they want it in a way that gives them the second strike advantage and that could be predictable in their regard. So, of course, Iran is going to respond, but it's going to respond strategically. It's going to respond with full intentionality and with full respect to its strategy, its own strategy, not Israel's. So I think this actually is what really terrifies Israel, that it is able to have short a lot of restraint in the short run, in order to achieve its goals in the long run. And Israel knows it can't, it can't really be successful in any military confrontation ultimately against Iran. So it just tries to also sabotage them militarily by inciting some kind of short-term, small-scale retaliation that Iran did with.
Now, Mahan, as you know, negotiations are underway in Vienna, and Al-Afshi is there, and they are starting it tomorrow officially. Not much was achieved in the first round of the Vienna talks last Friday, though. So what do you expect could come out of the second round that's starting tomorrow? Will go on for a couple of days. Tehran has asserted, of course, as you know, that it wants all the U.S. sanctions, and all the U.S. sanctions means those imposed during the Obama term, during the Trump term, to be removed at one go.
Well, as far as diplomacy in Vienna is concerned, Iran's position really hasn't changed. Iran's position was set out some time ago by the leadership and further down by the institutions that are tasked with foreign policy. So Iran's position is if Iran is going to scale back its actions of the past 18 months to go back into full compliance with the JCPOA, then sanctions not only have to be fully lifted. In fact, they have to be verifiably lifted, and that takes time. So it's no good for the Americans to say, oh, we're going to lift sanctions. Can you go back into your commitments now? Absolutely not. These have to be verified.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Iran will have to be able to sell its oil in the international markets without any obstacles or hindrance, and other sanctions.
And also get access to the money.
Yeah, and other sanctions. I was about to say that. Other sanctions targeting the financial sector, Iran's blocked assets around the world, they have to be unfrozen, and Iran needs immediate and full access to that. So these have to be verified. So the position in that regard hasn't changed. But look, just take a look at the discussion we've had this evening. Now, if this proves to be a synchronized attack by, say, two hostile states, I'm not going to name them because we don't have that information. So this is purely speculative. If one party, for instance, hopes to gain some kind of leverage over this attack. So, they would argue that Iran's leverage has been removed as a result of this attack, so it's easier to negotiate with them. Then the Iranian negotiators are going to prove them very wrong, because that bottom line is not going to change. It didn't change with the first round of the Vienna negotiations, and I suspect it will not change with the second one. And let's take stock of the broader strategic picture. The former U.S. administration imposed what they called maximum pressure policy in Iran, which amounted to a kind of economic blockade. That was an abysmal failure. The current administration in the U.S. concedes it was a failure, and yet it doesn't have the moral courage or the political conviction to actually reverse that policy.
Mm-hmm.
So until they reverse that mindset and reverse that policy, there's not going to be progress on the diplomatic aspect.
Okay, that's all the time we have had for this debate show. Let me thank my guests, web security analyst Mahan Abedin in Tehran, and journalist and commentator Julia Qassam, who joined us in Beirut in Lebanon with their comments and insight. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com
iranbnb.com/en.
The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, Ramadan has come again, and we have been invited to fast in this blessed month. From today, you'll be listening to a special series of programs titled The Month of God. This series will consist of three parts: moralities, Islamic laws, and supplications. We hope that God will accept your and our acts of worship and prayers. Stay tuned, please. The blessed month of Ramadan has come again. According to the Islamic narrations, this month is the month of God and God's banquet for the Islamic Ummah. God receives the faithful in this month with warm hospitality. God's banquet, unlike the worldly ones, is spiritual. In fact, God tells his servants to abstain from pleasures, even the permissible ones like eating, drinking, and so on. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, Ramadan has been called such because it burns the sins. In other words, the root of the word Ramadan in Arabic means burning. The fifth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, also says on the virtue of this blessed month, he who fasts the day in this month and spends the night in worship will be pure as the day he was born from his mother. The Prophet of Islam said on the threshold of the month of Ramadan, O people, the month of God has turned toward you with blessing, mercy, and forgiveness. It is month that is the best of months with God. Its days and nights are the best of days and months, and its hours are the best of hours. It is the month in which you have been invited to God's banquet and have been favored and dignified by Him. In this month, whenever you come toward God and sit at His presence, God will accept your prayer. In this month, help the poor and the destitute, respect the elderly, be kind toward children, and visit your relatives. O people, he who makes his temperament good in this month, on the day when steps sleep over the Sirat bridge, will pass over it easily. Thus, ask God with honesty, sincerity, and a pure heart to help you for fasting and recitation of the Quran, because miserable is the one who is deprived of God's mercy in this blessed and bounteous month. According to the Islamic laws, the sink of the crescent of Ramadan is possible in five ways. First, the individual sees it himself. Second, he becomes certain through hearing from others whom he trusts. Third, two just men say that they have seen the new moon. Fourth, the preceding month, Sha'ban, is 30 days. Fifth, the just ruler of the Islamic country announces the start of the month of Ramadan. The real property and wealth of human being is supplication to God. To achieve this property requires learning the practice of the prophets and leaders of religion. After the Prophet of Islam, his infallible successors have bequeathed to us ample concepts in the form of prayers and supplications. A considerable amount of these prayers and supplications belong to the blessed month of Ramadan. On the first eve of Ramadan, the fourth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, used to recite this prayer. Praise belongs to God who has guided us to his gratitude and made us worthy of thanking his goodness and granted us the reward of the righteous. And praise belongs to God who graced us with his religion and specialized us for his path and caused us to march in his ways of goodness, to move in them with his grace and favor toward his satisfaction. Such a praise that he accepts from us, and thereby becomes pleased with us. And praise belongs to God who designated among those paths his month Ramadan, the month of fasting, the month of Islam, the month of purity, the month of trial, the month of uprising, the month in which he sent down the Quran, a guidance for people and clear proofs of guidance and differentiator of right from wrong, and for this reason clarified the superiority of this month over other months on the basis of ample respect and obvious virtues. So he forbade what is permissible in other months, and in order to revere it, he prohibited foods and drinks in it and determined the specific time limit for it, which he, the Exalted and High, does not allow to be preceded or delayed. Then he made one of its nights superior over the nights of 1,000 months and called it Night of Qadr, in which angels and Ruh, the greatest angel, descend upon their Lord's commandments for every affair. And that night is healthy and blessed till dawn for any of his servants due to his ordainment that has become binding. O God, greet Muhammad and his progeny and inspire us the recognition of this month's superiority and its glorification and abstention from the forbidden acts, and assist us for fasting in it through keeping our bodily organs aloof from sins and using them in what satisfies you. Help us not to hear with our ears what is futile, and not to see with our eyes what is pervert, and not to extend our hands toward what is forbidden, and not to walk toward what you have banned. And help us so that our stomachs are not filled except with halal, and our tongues do not articulate but for what you have said. And help us so that we do not strive except for what takes us near to your reward, and so that we do not acquire except what preserves us from your punishment. Then purify all these from pretension and show off and seeking of reputation in a way that we do not associate in them anyone with you and do not pursue any purpose but you.
Good morning.
Iran, IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.